This episode is brought to you by 2020, where creatives go to get inspiring and authentic stock photos. If you're tired of scrolling through uninspiring, staged images, check out 2020. Their images are crowdsourced from real-world photographers, and you can choose from millions of high-quality photos available under a simple, royalty-free license. Today, 2020 is offering TGD podcast listeners a free trial of 5 photos so you can see for yourself. To start your trial, go to 2020.com/TGD. That's the word 20, then 20.com/TGD to get your first 5 photos free. Thank you, 2020. This is the Great Discontent Podcast. This conversation was recorded in front of a studio audience at the Wythe Hotel in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, as part of TGD Live, a monthly interview event series. Your lovely and well-dressed host for the night was Tina S. Maker. Enjoy the show.
Our first guest is a designer and developer born and raised in New York City. She grew up on the internet and began to code websites and games at the young age of 10. She earned her BFA in graphic design at the School of Visual Arts and served as senior product designer at SoundCloud before joining Etsy's design team. Passionate about building community, she previously led Tech Under 30 monthly events for newcomers in design and tech, and she is a co-founder of Good for POC, an initiative to help people of color in tech locate companies that put a focus on helping marginalized employees feel supported. Please give a very warm welcome to Kat Small. Hello. All right. Welcome.
Cheers.
Look out for that. So I saw you speak last year at the AIGA National Conference.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, I was there in the audience watching him. And so I'm super stoked to have you here tonight and learn more about your story. And I want to start at the beginning, as one does. So you were born and raised here in the Bronx. Tell me a little bit about growing up here and how that influenced your ideas about creativity.
Totally. So growing up in the Bronx, I grew up specifically near the Bronx Botanical Garden. It's an amazing place. It's actually one of the most like diverse areas in the Bronx. Like, there are so many cultures like overlapping in that one area. So we have like Irish people, we had like Latinx people, we had like so many different cultures kind of overlapping. There was like a bunch of Korean people also living in the neighborhood. So I really just grew up like feeling like diversity was like a really normal thing. And I absorbed so many different cultures during my pretty much like 18, 19 plus years living there. And I think it definitely gave me this like very international perspective, even though I grew up pretty much in the same household for a very long time. And eventually, when I was around the age of 18, I think I moved to another part of the Bronx, and it was like completely different. And it was like very heavily Caribbean, which was also really interesting and very different from what I was used to. So again, I kind of got like this huge mental shift of like, wow, I was super used to like all these different cultures, and now I'm experiencing this whole new one. So I know a lot about food, which is pretty exciting. But yeah, other than that, it was just great to be able to like interface with all these different kinds of people and really start to understand how they view life.
Was creativity a part of your childhood? Like, were you encouraged to express yourself creatively
totally.
As a kid? Like, what types of things were you doing other than, I know at 10 you started coding,
yes.
Which is crazy. Like, I want to talk about that in a minute. But yeah, as a child, like, what were you encouraged to do?
So when I was a kid, I did a lot of drawing and sketching. One of the first things I did when I was a kid was just like picked up a pencil and like tried to start drawing. I was really into Sonic the Hedgehog for a very long time. So I was like that early furry child. Just kidding, I'm not a furry. But I was super into Sonic the Hedgehog. I was really also into Sailor Moon later. So I created like all these custom characters. Sailor Moon fans, yes. So before I got super heavily into programming, I was already really into art. And then I was also at the same time going on the internet. And that's when I kind of started to find these communities where I could kind of like explore being an artistic creative person, doing this drawing, doing this painting, learning about like Bristol paper and getting really nerdy about like pen types. And then figuring out like, oh, cool, I can actually like start to merge those together.
So you taught yourself to code?
That was pretty fun. Yeah.
Okay. Child prodigy, like genius.
Woo. Woo. I feel like
what
I'm
year
alone.
Was that though?
That was around like 2000, 2001, okay. Like right when the internet died the first time. yeah, I obviously missed the awesome part of the first round of internet amazingness, but I was able to kind of find this community that was really interested in creating these dress-up dolls, and they had like this whole tutorial that just said, hey, if you want to make your own dolls, you have to use this random proprietary coding language, and you use Notepad, and you just type all day, and you hope that like what you're creating ends up looking like something that actually functions. And so I was able to actually draw these like ideas for these different outfits, and then I would scan them using a really old scanner and then draw them in MS Paint. And then once I had an idea of like all these different outfits, I was able to actually program it so that when you dropped a piece of clothing onto a character, it would like stick in the right place, and like all these really random things that actually ended up being super useful later for like web programming and video game programming. But it was this random proprietary scripting language.
So, okay, that's amazing. I don't know what I was doing at 10, but I was not doing that. Also, internet wasn't a thing. And so I guess take me from that point through high school and then college, you attended SVA and studied design. Like, at what point did you decide that that was going to be your path? Was there an aha moment?
When I was around 14 or 15, I kind of transitioned from, fine arts. Once I got bored with doing the dress up doll stuff, I kind of stopped coding and stuff for a very long time. And then when I was about 15 or so, I started doing graphic design work, and I got really into t-shirt design, and I got really back into blogging and all that kind of stuff. And so that kind of led me to realize, okay, well, if I want to do design work and be this professional designer, then I should probably go to design school, because that's it's actually really hard to figure out a lot of the concepts around being a designer. And I only applied to SVA after going to one of their pre-college programs. And I was like, this is the school I want to go to. There's all these super professional creators. And I didn't apply to any other school. And I got in, which is really, I'm thankful for that, because that would have sucked otherwise. But yeah, it was just this place, they've got people who are in the workforce. I want to learn from them. And then while I was there, I also learned more about JavaScript programming and HTML and CSS, and got really into doing digital design.
And so then I know you did internships even before college. Right. And you have done a lot in a small amount. I don't know if it's a small amount of time, but you've done a lot. You were an intern, then you were a junior product designer and then senior product designer, and you worked at many companies. And so can you Cliff Notes kind of take us through the timeline of your path since college?
Totes. So since college, the first job I had was an interface designer at a really small it was a very small product company that was a startup, and it was called Parks by Nature Network. And what they did was they would get commissioned to create these apps for national park services. And I was like, cool, sure, I'll do it. It's money. Never done that before. I like apps. So I did that for about 9 or 10 months. And then I was like, I'm not coding at all, and I'm kind of bored. So I then went to work at NASDAQ because they were doing product design. And they said, we're going to do lots of programming, and there's going to be design work, and you get to do user testing and all kinds of interesting things that I hadn't gotten to do before. So that was kind of the next step. Worked there for a while, and then wanted to be in a more co-located product team. So I went to work at a company that's now called Sports Rocket. And they were a content management system that was centered around videos. So I got to do a lot of complicated systems design and ship production code and be super agile about things, which was, again, really fun. And then I went to work at SoundCloud after that, and stayed there for about 2 years, and got to launch something that affected a very, very large number of people, which was, that was my first time getting to work on something that affected hundreds of thousands, if not millions of users. And after working there for 2 years, I got kind of tired of flying back and forth between Berlin and New York every couple of months. you'd be surprised that you get bored at that. but you do, I promise. And then I decided to work at Etsy. I get to work in the same borough where I live, which is really great. And everyone's really nice. And it's just amazing to get to work on something that's like benefiting the community of people we're creating for.
Yeah, I think we have, I don't know, does anyone in the room use Etsy as a platform to sell anything? Yeah, anyone?
See two
okay,
hands.
Yay. So, no, it's great. Like Etsy is such a great platform for indie creators to connect with their, you know, audience. It's wonderful. Like I could spend hours getting lost and like wish listing everything, like all the things I shouldn't buy but want. Right? And so yeah, tell me a little bit about what drew you to Etsy, because I know you've spoken about how great their company culture is and how inclusive they are. And then what do you do there currently?
So I decided to work at Etsy specifically because of a combination of things. I'd worked for a bunch of companies, as I just kind of mentioned, and some of them were like very people focused and some of them were not, and they weren't really thinking about like how the work that they were creating affected the world and like the ethics of the work that they were doing. And I really admired that Etsy clearly was focused on ensuring that they are supporting creators in an ethical way. They're also really dorky, which is really endearing and cute. But at the same time, the values that they have extend into pretty much everything they do. So they have like support groups at the office. The office itself has like better air than the outside world, which is pretty cool. and yeah, there's just a lot of, they really truly care about people, which I think is really exciting. And when I was looking for a new position, I really made sure to look at like, what is the scale of the product that I'd be working on, what resources do they have? And Etsy has a ton of people and a ton of support to do the things that they want to do, which is amazing. And then things like, what would I be working on every day? And what I do there is payments and checkout. So I'm the product designer who figures out a lot of the interfaces and systems around how people get paid and pay for things on Etsy, which is like pretty huge and terrifying, but awesome at the same time. Like it's such a complicated issue, and I'm really, every day I go into work, I'm excited to try to figure out like how these things work, because they're pretty complicated and they affect millions of people. So it's a really exciting challenge. And they totally also just support me wanting to do product design one day and do user research and then do some programming and spend all day in code. Like they're really down with like the flexible style of working, which is awesome.
That's wonderful. And you, in addition to work, you have a lot of extracurriculars that you've done in the past and that you're currently doing. Like you did, you led and organized Tech Under 30, which was meetups for newbies in tech and design. And then you are one of the co-founders of Good for POC, which I mentioned in your intro. And then you also helped a professor at NYU Polytechnic School of Engineering create the Code Liberation Foundation, which is a group by women for women that teaches women to program video games, which is like so badass. Seriously. So I guess it seems like you have a very clear focus on those, you know, passion projects or side projects that you want to be involved in. So what do you hope to contribute or give back to your community through those endeavors?
So what I'm looking for when I do those kinds of projects is, what's something that I felt wasn't there? Like when I'm looking for things like, why couldn't I find them and how can I kind of fill that gap? So when I was just starting out in tech at the time, it was very hard to find people who were also kind of new at the time for me to connect with. So I figured, well, if there's nothing there that's for newbies like me, I might as well like build this space. And then as we grew, we kind of found like, okay, it's a little hard to manage and it seems like maybe it's not needed as much anymore. So we kind of said, okay, well, let it die a little bit since it seems like it's not necessary. So anytime I build a project, I try to see like, is this something that people need right now? So things like Good for POC, things like Code Liberation, are they things that I personally believe in and feel like I can contribute to for a long period of time? And then I kind of put as much effort into it as I can. And then in a couple of cases, for example, with Code Liberation, I said, okay, well, I've done a lot of stuff for this and I feel like I can put that energy elsewhere. And then I just try to see like, can I kind of make it so it's sustainable by itself? If it is, then like COVID Liberation, we kind of keep it running and I kind of say, cool, I'll be over here and I'll show up at things. And it's really awesome that I could like be a part of something that kind of grew into this movement of sorts. But yeah, it's kind of like I go where the heart takes me, as cheesy as that sounds. And hopefully I find other people who believe in the same thing and we can make something really cool together and just see where it goes.
I know you're doing it because you want to give back, but have you personally experienced like growth or insights or just, you know, personal rewards through doing that work?
Every single time that I've done any of these projects, I get a lot out of it personally, whether it's through connecting with people or just like learning something. Like Tech Under 30 was the first time I got to do any form of like public speaking. And with some of these other projects, it's like I'll learn a new piece of technology or I'll do something that's more open source focused than I've ever done before. It's a little bit of like it's a chance to kind of stretch myself in ways that I'm very uncomfortable with, while also kind of contributing back to people and hopefully building communities.
Awesome. I think it's hard to voluntarily put yourself into a situation where you feel like, I can't do this, I'm not confident, I don't know how to do it. But when you jump into that, it's often not as scary as it seems. And then you learn and grow because you have to. And I think like, what better way to learn and grow than to just throw yourself into the deep end and figure it out, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Even though it's scary, but just
so
do
true.
It.
Yeah.
You can be scared. Do it anyway.
I mean, everyone else is scared too. Mm-hmm. So like you're coming into this thing together and hopefully you come out of it with something that's more amazing than when you started.
For sure. So you blog a lot and then you cross post, like you blog on your site, you cross post to Medium and share it all over the internet. I want to talk about your blog post on poverty and dream jobs. And you talk about the rise of unpaid internships and the fall of entry-level jobs. I like how many people listening or in the audience tonight have been asked to work for free for exposure or intern for free because it's a prestigious organization and it's like, you know, you got to pay the bills too. So, I want to quote something that you said in the post. You said, "This has been a growing problem for a long time and it continues to rise due to a multitude of factors that include the recession, its aftermath, and the American dream. As a millennial, I heavily identify with those who are going through the never-ending circle of internships. I know what it's like to have a dream and want to give anything to achieve it. However, I also know what poverty feels like, and because of it, I can't personally sacrifice my well-being for my artistic craft." So tell me about how you navigated this in your own life.
Ooh, deep.
That's deep. We're getting deep now.
Yes!
Those other questions were just warm-ups.
I love this. When I was a teen, my mom was like super affected by the recession that happened. And basically for several years, she and I kind of had to just like figure it out. I was at a certain point, I was just like, "Mom, I'll try to help you find jobs," being a really cute daughter trying to keep the dream alive. But while I was in college, that meant that I had to basically fund my way through school. So I couldn't do like unpaid internships at these really cool places. It meant that I had to specifically look for places that were paying me. And I guess that on one hand, it ended up being okay. But it kind of also was frustrating because I would go to class and then I'd go to work and I'd come home and I'd have to do homework. And then I'd show up for school the next day, totally dead and depleted and not able to do the same amount of work. In terms of how I kind of managed, I just, at the time I was able to do a lot of filtering basically to say, okay, well I have to look for these like certain search terms. And I ended up figuring out like the system around how to find like those paid jobs. I would also totally scare people off by like asking pretty quickly, like, is this paid or is it not? Or when I was looking through, the internship listings, I would just like search and see like, if it doesn't say paid, then I'm not like applying. It just made me a more stringent person. I think lately, a thing that's been really great is people are realizing that, I guess, as the talent pool grows, people can be maybe a little bit more, like, as people are looking for higher and higher quality of talent, I guess you could say, they're they have to pay people now because they're like, well, if we're competing with all these amazing places who are paying like fat stacks of cash, like we also have to pay reasonable amounts of money, which is amazing and exciting for me as a person who kind of grew up during this time period where it was really unclear if we would be able to like earn money from those kinds of jobs. So I have a more hopeful outlook now, which is really cool, but it definitely left me as a kind of person who's like, well, is this internship going to be paid? Like when I'm in charge of a job, I now ask, like, we have to pay people. Like we have to, everything I do is centered around ensuring that people get paid for their time because I know what it was like to be on the other side of that.
Look, you've likely heard of MailChimp, and there's a good reason why. More than 15 million people use MailChimp to connect with their customers, market their products, and grow their e-commerce businesses every day. But here's something you might not know. You can run Facebook ad campaigns right from MailChimp. Use the same simple design tools they give you for email to create great-looking ads. You can target ads at your audience or people similar to them, which is a great way to reach new customers. Track sales, customers, and subscribers all in one unified dashboard for both advertising and email. If you're looking to up your email game or try your hand at a Facebook ad campaign, MailChimp has the tools you need to grow your company in a way that feels right for you. We want to thank them for supporting the Great Discontent podcast. MailChimp, send better email, sell more stuff.
Okay, so I'm going to bring up our second guest. She is an artist and designer originally from New Orleans, but now based in Brooklyn, New York. She does a lot of things. She draws, photographs, cuts, prints, codes, and designs a variety of things for herself and others. From interactive paper to layered experimental websites, everything is done in her studio, which houses a 1919 letterpress. In 2015, she was part of Adobe's Creative Residency, and her pop-up book, This Book is a Camera, can be found in stores, and she has a forthcoming book, which we're going to talk about. This Book is a Planetarium, will debut this fall. Please give a warm welcome to Kelly Anderson. Yeah, you guys can switch.
Sorry.
Yes. Yeah. It's like a talk show. It's like Jerry Springer. You know, like the one person moves down. And
do we get to fight?
Do we have security ready to go? All right. Welcome, Kelly.
Thank you. It's actually such an honor to share a stage with Kat. So there will be no fights breaking out, I don't think.
So I love it when we have guests who know each other from Twitter but haven't met in person. So these two just met in person tonight and I think they're best friends now. I'm really good at connecting people. So if anybody needs a friend or, you know, I'm a good matchmaker.
Tina's matchmaking service.
I can, that's what I do on top of my normal work to pay the bills. I have extra services available. See me after the show. So we spoke in, was it July 2014? Because we did a feature for you on thegreatdiscontent.com. So if you want to know all of the details of Kelly's life, you can go there and read that. Tonight we're just going to do a flyover. So I guess let's start with what you're up to right now. And I know the biggest thing that you're working on is this book that's coming out in the fall. So can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah. So this book is a planetarium is indeed a book that's a planetarium. And I'm kind of like really good at literally titling things. So if anyone's working on a book and you're like, oh, it's a novel, you know, like I can come up with something that will spoil the plot. But yeah, that's my business model for when this design thing caves in, like the literal namer of things. Anyway, sorry, I'm going to be serious. So This Book is a Planetarium is a pop-up book of highly minimalist functional contraptions. And so everything in the book is paper, but it works and performs certain tasks. So the planetarium, for example, is this paper half dome with all of these little apertures cut into it for the stars. And you turn on the flashlight of your phone and like hide under your covers or in your tent or in your closet and it projects stars into the ceiling. So it's this experiential thing, but there's also text because it's a book and it explains why these things work. And so the constellations, or the planetarium rather, explains, you know, why projection works. Like, why does light travel in a straight line and make these stars on your ceiling? Why does the stars on your ceiling, why might it vary from the nighttime sky outside, you know, depending on your place on Earth and what season it is? So there's also a guitar, a speaker, a spirograph, a encryption tool, like a decoder ring thing, a perpetual calendar, And I think that's it. So it's this collection of things that basically teaches you about, like, how the world works through experience. It's kind of like a science book for people who, like, want to enter science from this, like, tactile realm. So, like, artists and designers and, you know, most humans who don't have a PhD in engineering or math. So, yeah.
What does it take to make paper do those things?
I think stubbornness.
Well, you've been on production on this book for a little while.
Yeah. Yeah. So when we met in 2014, I was wrapping up like the design of the book, and I thought like, oh, this was the hard part because I figured out how to make paper like be a guitar. Did I mention that? There's a guitar.
You did.
Okay. Yeah. So I was like, okay, that this is the heavy lift here is like figuring this shit out. Can I say shit? Okay.
Yeah, you can do that too.
But yeah, no, it's not. I really had a hard time working in the adult, very grown-up world of publishing because basically my problem was that like I had, well, the problem was manyfold. This book shouldn't be made. I mean, paper should not perform as a planetarium and a speaker and a guitar or whatever. So that's problem number one. Like book publishers and the book publishing industry don't really understand like the tedious sort of constraints and parameters that go into like manufacturing such things. So I was on one end with all of this technical information, but with degrees from art school, not from engineering school. And then there were the people on the other side who were producing the book who also had technical know-how and ideas. And then there was the publisher in the middle. So it was like this weird game of telephone where I couldn't talk to those other people. I had to sort of send it through the publisher who didn't understand anything. And then I was like, it was like kind of like putting a message in the bottle and I'd ship it out. And then like prototypes would float back and it'd be like, I don't even know what this is, you know? And so then like you'd have to backtrack and think like, okay, well, like, did they get my documentation? If they did, then they're misinterpreting it in this way. And so it was this, like, really weird, like, I don't know. I mean, it basically used all of my skills of analyzation to figure out like what I should tell people to like get a result I wanted. It was hard. I mean, it's been years of like, yeah, yeah. No more. I'm not gonna say any more. I'm gonna get in trouble. No one's gonna wanna work with me ever again. I swear I'm not that much of a perfectionist. I'm just a little bit.
You just need things to work in the way that you want them to work. But also, so let's talk about this more, but I want to frame it differently. Because you take these, you know, you take paper and the mediums that you work in, like you really push them to their limit. Like you do things with paper that shouldn't be done, like paper shouldn't be a guitar. And so I guess I'm wondering, like, how did you begin working in this way? Because it's challenging. It's like, you know, you're kind of a glutton for punishment because you're trying to do these things that really shouldn't be possible, but yet they are.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, yeah, I guess it's kind of like a leap of faith. Like in theory it should work. And so therefore I'm determined to make it work. I guess the way I got hooked on doing this kind of project was I made a paper record player wedding invitation for my friends, Mike and Karen, who are like big time music nerds. And so they approached me to make their wedding invitation. They're like, oh, we want it to be about music and it should probably be interactive because our friends are smart and they're not going to be happy with like just like a normal wedding invitation. And so we were like, all right, well, their idea was like, okay, it should be sheet music that people can then perform. And I was like, okay, but like that just didn't seem satisfying enough to me. So I was like, hey, do you guys remember that episode of Mr. Wizard where they made a record player with a rolled up cone of paper and a needle? And they totally did. And they're like, okay, well, yeah, let's try to do this for our wedding invitation. And so I made just like a ton of prototypes and figured out how to make a bent piece of paper and a needle play a record. And we manufactured it. By manufacture, I mean like I glued together 200 of them on my dining room table. Yeah, and then all of their friends were delighted. I mean, some of them were probably really confused by it, but I videotaped it. Oh my God, I'm from the past, guys. I'm so sorry. With a digital camera, no tape was involved or harmed. Oh my God, I'm embarrassing myself. Yeah, so yeah, I filmed it. and put it on the internet, and people like freaked out. Like, it was like one of the first projects I ever put on the internet, and it went viral, like legitimately. And so I thought this was normal. And yeah, and it was really crazy because like then after I made that, like the entire world was coming at me that like everyone wanted their wedding invitation to be a record player too. And I, you know, these friends that I made this invitation for, like, I really care about them. Like, they're really special. And this was like sort of like an act of love in a way. And I was like, I can't just like sell this idea to like a German company who makes cards. And I don't know, it just seemed like icky. I was like, there's something here. There's some reason why I think it's really cool and other people are responding to it. I need to figure out like what that underlying reason is and then make work, you know, from that reason rather than just like cashing in. Also, I'm stupid about money. So yeah.
Kat, were you going to say something? I saw you grab your mic.
I was just going to say that, like, I was totally one of those people who freaked out.
Oh,
it was absolutely amazing.
Yay. I feel really cool now. Thanks,
yeah,
Kat.
I think that's when I first came across your work. That was, like, the thing. I was like, what? What is this thing? This is incredible. So doing work in that way, I imagine, leads to a lot of frustrating moments and disappointments and setbacks. So how do you... I mean, I think, like... many of us, no matter the discipline we work in, you know, we reach those points where we kind of hit a wall or we have creative block or we get stuck. But I imagine it's much more intense for you when you're dealing with physical objects that you have to then like just literally trash and throw away. How do you deal with the disappointments and the frustrations and maybe the self-doubt, you know, all of those hard things?
Yeah, it's true. I have this dual curse in that, like, I keep on getting invited to speak at design conferences. And so I think people follow me and then they're really disappointed that I make nothing for like a year. So it's like I have nothing to like post on Instagram on a day-to-day basis. And like that's kind of like what being a creative, I mean, it's kind of like about like making small projects that are sustainable. But yeah, anyway, I'm a long-term project person right now. And yeah, it kind of sucks. Like, it's not fun. I guess, you know, when I have to throw away 10 prototypes in a row, I just go get ice cream and then it's a little bit better. But I mean, I think the fortunate, well, the blessing and the curse for me is that I learned all of this in a very in my own way. So I'm literally feeling it out. Like, I don't know anything about anything. Like, I mean, I studied physics a little bit. I know math a little bit, but I have no formal training in any of these fields. And so the fortunate thing for me is that when I hit a wall, there are like people in the world who like understand how these things work and I can go bother them, which it took me a while to like even figure that out. But, that's a good lesson to learn that like, yeah, there's things that you can borrow from other disciplines for sure.
Calling, phoning a friend, asking for help.
Yeah, exactly.
So when I asked you guys to be guests together, I didn't realize that you both have done a TEDx talk.
If you're scary, right?
If you're listening at home,
terrifying.
They just high-fived each other. It was awesome. So you, okay, Kat, you talked about changing the face of game development, and Kelly, you spoke on designing to change reality. So yeah, can you give us like a brief overview of kind of what you talked about? Kat, go
first.
Yeah,
sure. So my talk specifically was about the work that I did with Code Liberation, and a little bit, I kind of railed a little bit on lecture-based learning for things like programming and, like those kinds of fields where it's kind of a little bit better to be hands-on, at least for people like me who got a little bit terrified of like going into computer science or a field like that, because it's less about like being on a computer and kind of just working things out. And it's more of just like staring at a wall for like several hours per day. So the work that we did with Code Liberation specifically was around like the special way of teaching, where we made it less about the teacher and more about the people in the class actually kind of getting that hands-on experience and really grasping the concepts that we're teaching them.
That's awesome. And Kelly, can you give us a brief overview of your TEDx talk? And then you guys can go Google these and watch them later.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the best way to say it is, I've learned a lot from working with paper, because paper is a material that no one expects anything about, just because it's so prevalent in our everyday lives that you take it for granted. So, you know, your student loan bills arrive on it and you use paper napkins and whatnot. But like, paper is structural, so it can like tap into all of these, you know, hidden forces in the universe. And there are a lot of like large scale problems that can be modeled in paper. And so it has this sort of like surprisingly profound dimension to it. And I realize that like a lot of things in everyday life have this. It's like these experiences get kind of worn out from overuse. But I wanted to express in the TEDx talk that, you know, the experiences that are the most worn out are also, you know, hold the most opportunity for hacking and really like surprising people and like, you know, showing them that the universe is amazing. So the TED Talk was like officially about this concept of disruptive wonder, which then like disruption like became like a startup thing. And it was like, oh my God, I can't believe I said that. But yeah, no, I totally like believe in the ideas of it still. Yeah, even if I don't like the term, but yeah, kind of the idea of like, you can use art and design as this like surrealist intervention and sneak into like everyday life and like hack a newspaper or hack a paper card. So yeah, it was about that.
So I think when I brought up that you guys both did the TEDx talk, you like high-fived each other, but then you gave each other a look like, oh my God, wasn't it so scary and hard? I think, you know, public speaking is like right up there on like, you know, worst fears ever. And you, Kat, have an awesome resource that you publish. It's, I don't know how many parts it is, but it's a 10-part series on your blog, and it's all about how to become a public speaker in a year. And basically you took it upon yourself to say, I need to do more public speaking. I'm going to go through the process, throw myself into it, be uncomfortable, and learn from it. So if you guys have not seen that, like, go to Kat's site. It's like a really excellent resource, and it breaks down like each step of, you know, if you want to learn to be a good public speaker, or you want to like, you haven't done it and you want to like dip your toe in the water, check that out. But what have you guys learned? You know, it's so important to be able to speak about our work in front of people, which is so, so scary. But what have you guys learned from doing that, from speaking at conferences and events and whatnot? Go for it, Kat.
So I've learned so much about just personal potential in terms of like, when I think I can't do something, like in reality, it actually is possible with a little bit of like effort and just like a lot of discomfort. But otherwise, yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing I've learned about public speaking is that if I don't talk about what I'm doing, then no one really knows that I'm doing anything worth like thinking about or looking at. So I found that through the public speaking that I do, and it can also be, you know, expressed as like writing or some kind of really good social media game. Like, there are many ways to kind of like broadcast the things that you're doing or share the ideas that you have. And I found that public speaking was one of the quickest ways to like do that, because when you're in front of someone, like we're all together right now, and I'm with you at home for those of you who are listening. But you know, it's like more, it just feels more real, I think, for a lot of people than like broadcasting your ideas online, and you can actually interface with people in real life. And I think there's something beautiful about like being able to affect people and just talk to them and hope that they think my ideas make sense. And if they don't, then we can just have a really nice conversation about it, hopefully nice.
And Kelly, what have you learned from public speaking?
Well, to all of the visual people out there, like, human society still runs off of words, like for better or for worse. And there's like a lot of ideas that like we deal with that just aren't translatable into language. And I'm not saying that to be pretentious, like legitimately like try to like explain verbally like the difference between two different colors, or try to explain verbally like how like basil or cilantro tastes. Like, there are some things that are just like inherently experiential. And the reason why art history writing seems so pretentious to a lot of people is because it's just really hard to describe these ideas. But I think it's a worthwhile pursuit. And yeah, like, I don't know. The thing I learned about public speaking, like, I when I went and did the TEDx talk, like I literally felt like I knew what a heart attack felt like. I was like, oh, I get this. I don't have to experience this. Like, I totally understand. Like, my boyfriend Daniel's here. Like, I practiced probably like 500 times, and I almost ran, like, bolted. Like, they mic'd me up, and I almost just, like, ran out of the theater. I was like, I don't really have to do this. Yeah, it was really, really, really scary. But at some point in time, I realized that, like, the key for me, like, the way I've talked myself into actually enjoying it, like, I actually legitimately enjoy public speaking now, which is something I never thought I'd say, is just to be, like, super over-prepared and enjoy yourself. Like, really, you can choose to enjoy yourself. Like, you can make that choice and then just enjoy yourself. And, like, yeah, so now this is fun. I'm enjoying myself.
So almost an hour in, Kelly is enjoying herself.
Yeah.
So, Kelly, I want to bring up something that you mentioned when we spoke in July 2014. So, you know, I love to ask people about, you know, are you creatively satisfied? What's your level of creative satisfaction? Yada, yada. And you had a really wonderful response. I want to read it and then ask both of you a question. So when I asked you about your level of creative satisfaction, you said, I don't think there can be a sense of stasis. There's always an urge to move forward and do more. And it's inevitable that each project leads to more questions. Satisfied sounds like a terminus, and it's not like that. It's a continuing inquiry. So, yeah, that's good, right?
Very nice.
So what are each of you inquiring about right now? Is there anything that you are looking forward to doing this year that you want to explore, you know, professionally, like with client work or personal work, things on the side? Who wants to go first? Kat's jumping in.
Sure. God, I have like a never-ending list of things that I want to do, but the current thing that I'm working on is more game development stuff, because I'm hopefully going to port a game that I've been working on called Breakup Squad to a console, so we'll see how that goes. But that's like my current, like, how do I do this? Like, how do I make this happen? How much do I have to spend to get a developer kit? Like, so that's kind of like the thing that's going on in my brain. But yeah, there's like an endless list of just like stuff that I can do hopefully before I die.
And Kelly, do you have a next up on the list?
Yeah, well, I just took an open frameworks class at the School for Poetic Computation. Those are the best people. You guys should go take classes from them. Yeah, categories. This is an advertisement. Yeah, but I mean, it's funny because like I've kind of found this like weird niche where it's like, oh, Kelly, she's the person who makes things out of paper that does crazy things. And so it's funny because like when I was struggling with the mystery of like, why is the paper record player wedding invitation cool? It was this mystery that I was chasing, and it was like really super exciting. And then once I feel like I nailed it down, then I immediately became restless and I'm like, wait, what am I going to do next? So I am actually trying to finesse that paper record wedding invitation into a consumer like appropriate pop-up book. And so there's going to be like a This Book is a Record Player pop-up book that's going to be a much better, like higher sound quality thing. But now that almost like, even though it's so whimsical and ridiculous, that kind of seems like a job now. So that's almost done. I've designed like 300 covers for it so far, and I don't really like any of them yet. I know. Yeah, I know. It's a sickness. Yeah, I also like saw this like really, really crazy video on the science website for Nature of these like really interesting forms that interact in this cool way. That's my daydream. Like I'm daydreaming about those forms and what I can do with them. I can't even describe it. I just have to like send you a video.
Okay. I need to see that video because yeah, the words did not.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to do a good job.
Okay. Yeah, that's awesome. I think, you know, it's never about having enough ideas. It's about having enough time. And so that kind of brings me to the last topic I want to touch on, which is, you know, balance. I don't know if any of us up here on the stage have a lot of balance in our lives, but it's, you know, it's something I struggle with. I think it's something that many of us struggle with, especially in New York, because we work full-time jobs, we have side projects, or we juggle a couple part-time jobs. I mean, there's always more that you can do. And I think socially there's pressure because our peers are all doing so much. So it's a little, there's a little competition there. But Kat, you wrote a blog post because you blog a lot. So I'm referencing all of your blog. I read all of your blog posts in preparation. One of your blog posts that you wrote about balancing your full-time job and freelance projects, you listed a few tips, and there were a couple that struck me, and I want to read those. Tip one, don't sacrifice your happiness for others. Tip two, appreciate the slow days. And tip three, remember to live, exclamation point. So I think those are all pretty self-explanatory, and I think those are things that we forget and we don't do many times. So I guess I'd like to hear from both of you, like, what are you currently doing, or what helps you feel more balanced between, you know, client or full-time work and personal projects, and then, you know, just life in general?
Yeah. I need to like reread that like every day of my life. But yeah, I think what I've been trying to do as of late is to, so I like, I'm the person who like has a Google calendar that's like pristine, and I manage it to a T. If it's not on the calendar, I'm not going to be there. Like, it doesn't exist in my head. So I actually have to, oh yeah.
Well, I just want to ask, because I do this too, is it color coded?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Oh girl, yeah. I want to like, compare, yes. Because
it's amazing.
I also have a color coded calendar. People make fun of me. They're like, you use the Google calendar? I'm like,
it's great.
It is so great. Like, you guys don't know, because my life is so organized and I feel great about it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You can hate on me all you want. I feel awesome. And I don't miss my appointments.
Yeah. There's a certain magic about like being able to be on time for everything, because your phone tells you when you need to leave for stuff. Like, it's all around great. But I do sometimes, because of that, forget to like actually just calm down and do nothing. So I've started actually scheduling time to like hang out with people and maybe go to the park, go rock climbing, be a person. And I found that just by like doing a little bit of that, where I'm like, I block out all these times for work, but I didn't ever stop to think like, oh, what about just, you know, me not having to hang out with like business people and doing all of this business cat stuff, like just being a person. So just by like scheduling some time in to kind of be a normal person, explore New York and just even like go for a walk outside or take care of myself, has been pretty great. So I've got like the time to like do my hair and all those kinds of things. And that's been amazingly helpful. I think also like every now and then I'll step back and ask myself, like, am I working on things that I still believe in and still care about? And most of the time I have the privilege to be able to say like, oh, well, if I'm not really interested in doing this thing anymore, then I can be honest and kind of like pause it for now until I feel re-energized and can come back to that thing. So that's kind of how I try to keep myself like focused and centered and doing things that I like, while also kind of having this like day-to-day time to like chill out and just be a cool, normal person.
That's awesome. Did you know that you can do, in Google Calendar, you guys are not going to be interested in this, but I'm going to say it anyway. You can do, I think it's called goals.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. It is awesome. I was like, goals, exercise 3 times a week. I'm like, defer. Okay.
That's my life.
So no, I did work out today. Actually, I joined a gym last week. So, or maybe 2 weeks ago, but anyway, yeah, you can do goals. So the goals are kind of like fluid, and the goals fit in between your scheduled to-dos that are not flexible. And so it's a nice way to remind yourself, like, you know, call a friend, work out, you know, call your parents, go outside and take a walk. Yeah. All right. Cool. Makes me happy that you know about that.
Of course. You are with the right people.
Okay. Kelly, what do you do to find balance or try to find balance?
Yeah, I have no work-life balance at all, but like, you would not believe me, but it's not unsustainable. That was like a double negative. It's fine. Like, I'm fine. I think like for me, it's less about balancing work and life and more about balancing the fun and the not fun. Like, that's like the thing that I think needs to be in balance. But yeah, I and also like, I feel like I don't understand leisure time, and I've kind of forgiven myself as a human for that. Like, I don't understand sitting on the beach. I don't understand, like, doing nothing. Like, I don't understand. I'm, like, too hyperactive, I think, or something. I don't know. Whatever. Judge me. But but I do think that it's really important for me to carve out spaces in my work that are, like, goalless, you know? That's, like, open-ended exploration where there's no end product that I want. There's nothing that I want to accomplish, that I just want to see where it goes. And so that's part of why I took this Open Frameworks class, because it's literally like all of the code that does something adequately cool to entertain me, like, is so complicated I don't understand it. So I literally have no clue what's going to happen when I, like, type in numbers. And, like, the same with, like, I do this series on Instagram called Made with Rules, where it's kind of like the work that Solowit does. Like, I come up with a rule and then find a data set, like, you know, the numbers taken from speed cameras in New York City this morning, and plug that in and, like, make, like, an artwork, you know, an abstract work representing it. And so, like, that kind of stuff is, like, really super fun for me, because it's kind of like, I think it does the same thing for me that, like, sitting on the beach does for other people. I don't know. There's something wrong with me, maybe.
No, I
but,
mean,
yeah, there you go.
I mean, I will say, like, I really agree about the point of just, like, I mean, I have a lot of energy, and it's like, if I'm not doing something that feels like I'm properly, like, getting that energy out, then I just,
like,
get
the world
really
is
weird.
Burning. How can we just, like, sit at the beach?
Yeah, yeah, no. So,
right?
Like, sadly, yeah, I don't get to go on beach walks, but I'll do things like play this weird video game and kind of, like, make it feel like I'm doing research for my next video game when I'm really just playing a video game. And that's, like, you're making art, and it's like, I'm kind of, you know, like, I'm getting this energy out, but I'm not, like, doing this, like, worky work work.
Can you write off video games on your tax returns?
I think so.
That's
yeah,
awesome.
Everyone should make games, because if you form an LLC, then you can write it on your taxes.
Yeah, or just call yourself an artist, and, like, everything's research.
Smart lessons.
I went to the amusement park. I learned about experiences.
It is tax season, so. Also, our accountant is here tonight.
Woo!
Scott!
Scott! If anyone... Okay.
We're gonna have to talk later.
If anyone needs an accountant, he's the best. Seriously, though. So I have one last question. And I love the how you're like, you do work that's work and you do work that's fun. And for you, the fun work is, like, sitting on the beach. I totally would be the person sitting on the beach, but I also get what you're saying, and I appreciate that. So when both of you think about the things that you need in your life to feel the happiest and most fulfilled, I guess, you know, what are those things? And the question is, for this coming year, the rest of the year, like, what's one thing that you need in your life to feel happy and fulfilled that maybe you don't have in your life now, or you want to, like, reincorporate back into your life?
Whoa. Let's see. That's hard. I think I want to travel more. It's weird because, like, I got tired of travel when I had to do it constantly, and then just, like, I was, like, somewhere basically, like, every other week or so for a while, and that was way too much. But, like, lately I've just kind of been like, oh wow, I'm not really going anywhere this entire month. That's weird. So I started to feel a little bit like I want to do that a little bit again. So I think we're trying to figure out, like, can we go to Japan, for example, and just, like, be in a different place, which would be really fun. So that's something I think I would like to do by the end of this year, to kind of, like, feel, because I've, like, gotten used to going to, like, San Francisco and places like that where it's like, oh, I almost kind of feel like I live here now. I know these street names and all that stuff. So just going somewhere I either haven't been for a long time or somewhere completely new is what I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, I would, like, ditto everything you said. I want to do more traveling, for sure. And Kelly, you, anything?
I'm going to sound like a tunnel vision robot.
It's okay.
Okay.
Just be you.
That's me. I'm, like, going to rip off the Scooby-Doo mask. Like, my record player prototype, like, it's really hard to spin it at a consistent speed so people don't sound like the chipmunks one minute and, like, the devil the next. And, like, I need to figure out some physical mechanism to make it easier to spin, because, like, it's really fun to have these things that are manually controlled, because it's like people can connect what they're doing with their hand with this phenomenon that usually occurs within this like black box technology. And so like, I want that like tactile control where it's like giving you feedback, but I also want it to be like a fulfilling experience for people so that they achieve a result that they are proud of and like want to show it to their friends and want to play with it. And it's like so close. And like, in order for me to be a full human and go on with my life, like I have to figure out this problem. That's all I care about right now.
So we all really hope that you figure this out soon.
Yeah. I mean, I also care about resisting Trump. I mean, yeah, I've been designing things for like the tax march and I have diorama ideas for the science march. So like that is like, seriously, Trump getting elected is the one thing that has distracted me from like haze on the speed issue. I've been thinking about the speed issue for like a year. Yeah. That's it. I'm lame.
We love you.
Oh, well, thanks, guys. I love you too.
This is an incredible way to end. So those are all the questions I have. Again, Kat Small, Kelly Anderson. Yeah.
This episode was produced by The Great Discontent and me, Benjamin Welch. The Great Discontent features in-depth conversations with today's artists, makers, and risk-takers. You can learn more at thegreatdiscontent.com. And of course, you can subscribe to this show in iTunes or wherever you find your podcasts. And if you enjoyed this episode, please consider giving us a rating in iTunes. It really does help spread the word. Thanks so much for listening.